This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. Since the first protests on May 26th, millions of people across America and across the world have taken to the streets to express their grief and anger and demand justice for the killing of George Floyd by Minnesota law enforcement.
With rubber bullets, my cameraman has been hit. We've also seen tear gas being used. Here we go, they're moving through again.
But that's not the outdoors community, right? The outdoors is for everyone. Naturalists are so welcoming. Well, it might seem like 100 years ago now, but just before the very first protest began, another racist incident was already sparking outrage online.
So there's an incident in New York Central Park caught on camera, and it's going viral.
Christian Cooper, a black man who had been birdwatching in New York City for decades, was in the Ramble, 36 acres of semi-forested woodland in Central Park, when he asked a nearby woman to obey the park rules and leash her dog. She refused, and before the confrontation ended, the woman called the police while Christian recorded her with his smartphone.
Amy Cooper has apologized but was fired from her job. Join me now as Christian.
We say Outside In is a show about the natural world and how we use it, but the history of these spaces will show that white gatekeepers have long held a great deal of power in deciding who gets access to the natural world and how. And it points to how the experience of public outdoor spaces isn't the same for everyone. Brenton Mock wrote in an article for CityLab that peaceful, green spaces just as easily induce anxiety and trauma for black and brown people, especially when they know the cops can be unleashed at any moment. But this particular incident has also inspired what you might call a celebratory response. It's called Black Birders Week. This past week, the initiative has been sharing pictures, stories, and holding online events that highlight black voices, while at the same time examining how outdoor spaces can be implicitly or explicitly threatening and dangerous for people of color. Danielle Bellany is a wildlife biologist and one of the core organizers behind Black Birders Week. Danielle, thank you so much for being with me.
Oh, I'm excited to be here.
I kind of want to just start with a little real talk. So, like, if there are listeners out there who are rolling their eyes and saying, like, do we need to bring race into birding too? Like, can we just bat that aside? Like, what are the types of experiences that you've had with white birders?
Yeah, so, I mean, the fact that people think that racism doesn't happen in the birding community is pretty, I mean, it's laughable to me. Racism is going to happen anywhere where I am. It's because I'm black that racism happens to me. I've been followed around by people that are on trails because I think I look suspicious with my binoculars while I'm staring at bushes or like trees and stuff. Or I've also had the cops called on me while I've been working. And it's really frightening when those situations happen. And it's just like, I'm just trying to do my job. I'm trying to like be out here and enjoying a nature just like the rest of us.
Can you just tell me a little bit about yourself, like your relationship with the natural world, how you got excited about it, what it means to you?
Sure. So I am from San Antonio, Texas. I was definitely a very outdoorsy kid growing up. I would pick up the bugs from the lawn. I would pick up snakes too, like as like a 5-4-year-old. Definitely fearless from the jump of it. I did not know that wildlife biology was something you could actually pursue as a job. I thought you could only be like a zoo keeper or like a veterinarian to work with animals. But no, it turns out there's so many other opportunities. And what got me really into research and really into birds was this internship I had doing nest searching in South Texas. And I basically got to watch baby birds grow up the whole summer. And it was really really, really cool to see how a bird turns from an egg to a full bird in like a couple of days. It's an unbelievable process. And I've been watching this black-throated hummingbird nest in my backyard, my first ever hummingbird nest that I found. They just left the nest yesterday, and I'm so happy to be able to watch that whole process happen. It's just magical.
I love it. We have Phoebes that nest under the porch every year, and the great thing about them being under the porch is you can look between the cracks of the boards and like peek at them like really, really close, like a couple inches above the nest. It's so fun.
Cute.
I know. So how did it come together? Because I have to confess, I saw the hashtag, I saw a bunch of, you know, my feed was sort of full of it. But then it wasn't until I clicked on the organizers list and saw how many co-organizers there are that I realized this is really something that, you know, it seems like it came together very quickly, but a lot of enthusiasm from a lot of different quarters.
Oh, absolutely. So immediately after the incident, you know, the black scientist, the black STEM group that I'm in, we have a group chat, and we were just, you know, just chatting. It's usually there just for us to hang out and like have a space to be together. But when this incident happened, we were like, oh, we have to say something about this. So a couple of us just had some independent tweets. But then back in the group, Anna Gifty Opuku Agayeman, she is an economist with no background in birds or wildlife sciences. She was like, you guys could actually make a thing out of this. Like, this can get some attention. And within 2 days, we had Blackbirders Week organized. We had all kinds of things, you know, lined up. And I think the excitement to put our voices out there and to also just create a community with Black outdoor enthusiasts helped us and pushed us to go all those sleepless hours to create this event in 2 days. It's amazing.
Yeah. And it seems like you've had a lot of interest because, you know, I just heard someone being interviewed on 1A earlier on NPR for the full hour. And we had like, I think, 5 listeners email us and say that we should do something about it. And it's just been everywhere.
My jaw is dropping right now. That's so cool.
So what were the goals? Like, what did you want to accomplish with this?
First off, to uplift and recognize that Black birders and Black outdoor enthusiasts exist. Oftentimes, you know, especially a hobby like birding is considered like, that's an old white guy kind of activity. Like, oh, that's pretty boring. Like, why would you do that? We wanted to provide reassurance through community by reaching out and letting other people that are maybe isolated in their interest know that no, you have friends. We are here. Come join us, even though it's online. We definitely have a community. We also want our non-Black peers to, you know, understand the experiences that Black birders and Black outdoor enthusiasts have, that we're often uncomfortable and unwelcome in these spaces. And we're really just out there trying to find a release, trying to get rid of the stressors that, you know, Black people have on their lives. We are responding to the incident with Christian Cooper and Amy Cooper, but this is also about the murders of other Black lives like Breonna Taylor, Monica Diamond, Ahmaud Arbery, George Floyd, so many other Black lives being lost because of white supremacy and because of racism.
We on the show have done one birding episode a while ago. I interviewed a guy who was like who at the time had the big year record. Mm-hmm. And so I have an entree into birder culture with Ooh. Like the listers and the twitchers and like the people who are very sort of, it's almost like a sport. I guess I'm wondering is how welcoming this sort of like quirky, insular, sometimes birding community has been to Black birders. Not just the stories of people seeing you with suspicion when you're out there with binoculars, but how actual other white birders react when there's suddenly someone who doesn't look like them in their group.
Right. So for the Twitchers, I just learned that word last night. So that's eye-opening to me. Like, oh, y'all get called that? Okay, cool. I'll stick with birders. but I think birders in general just want more birders. Want more birders to be birding. Want more people to have interest in birds. Because once you like slide somebody into like one little niche interest, they eventually understand like a grander scale of how conservation is really, really important. And you can do that by studying birds and being interested in birds and sending money to bird organizations. I think birders as a whole are very inviting. However, again, you know, once you get inside the group, you do start to realize, oh, you know, yeah, this is the same racism that I experienced when I'm, you know, at school or some other activity. The racism is still the same, but I think the welcomingness of birders and how they're so interested in birding definitely draws people in.
I had seen you tweet that sometimes you feel like you're getting quizzed, like are you really a birder? And they'll like ask you extra questions about like making sure that you're properly IDing birds that, you know, can make you feel like a little bit of an outsider.
Yeah, and that happened less than, I think, like 2 weeks ago. I was out in San Antonio out birding because I just needed to go out. This group of white birders were looking in a bush, and I was like, oh, they seem really excited. Maybe there's something interesting over there. So I walk up to the group and like, hey, what are y'all looking at? They turn around and look at me. They don't say anything, turn back around, start looking at the bird again. I'm like, okay, maybe they didn't hear me, even though I'm a respectable socially distance away from them. But I'm like, okay, let me just ask them one more time. And they turn around. This time they actually like acknowledge me and they're like, oh, it's a gray catbird. I'm like, oh, okay, cool. And I'm here in like my bird hat and like my bird scarf and like my bird shirt. Like I'm fully nerded out in bird gear. Right. And I think
it's like, how else could I be signaling to you that
honestly,
I belong?
My binoculars are on my chest. I've been like with my eBird app. Like I look like such a dork right now. Like let me be a dork with y'all. But I mean, I also don't care about the projections of white birders and what they think of me. I'm going to do what I do because I love it. And I don't need their validation to do that.
What would you recommend for Black people who are listening, who are interested in doing things like bird watching, but maybe feel hesitant because it is seen as such a white hobby and they need a little inspiration?
Do you? I mean, you can go out birding without binoculars. As long as you have an interest and a passion, that's really all you need. Also, you know, find us online at Black AF and STEM. We want to hear your voices. We want to connect with you. Like, that's why we are here.
And then... Also, any recommendations for white people who are listening and, you know, ways that they could be better in terms of being welcoming and being allies?
Sure. Yeah. I would say speak up when you hear something that is racist. Like, we need our allies to be actively anti-racist. And also donate. I mean, if you can donate to a local Black organization, a Black nature organization or something, to help other Black kids get access to these wonderful things that are outside, paving the way for more diversity. If we understand like the importance of ecological diversity in a system, the fact that we have so many connections through so many species and it makes a more resilient community, we can do that same thing through diversity in our spaces. It'll make a more stronger and more resilient community in the same sense.
Right. Okay. So this will air on Saturday, which will mean that, you know, officially Black Birders Week is over. But obviously the importance of this isn't going anywhere. So I guess what's next?
Yeah. Yes, Black Birders Week is ending soon, but I mean, Black Birders Week is forever. Like, we're going to be out here, like, every day. Black AF and STEM, we are a very biology, wildlife science heavy group, but we need to highlight more Black voices in all STEM topics. So come over and join our group so you can get highlighted in whatever really cool, interesting thing in STEM that you do. But yeah, we're going to keep doing this. This is not where we're going to stop. Next year, yeah. Black Birders Week is going to be even more poppin'.
Yeah, every week is Black Birders. Awesome. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
Danielle Bellany is a wildlife biologist and one of the co-organizers behind Black Birders Week. Search the hashtag on Twitter to see some of the incredible posts from this week, and you can follow Black AF in STEM to keep tabs on what's next. There are so many amazing, inspirational, and sometimes heartbreaking stories that were shared this week for Black Birders Week. So Danielle and her co-organizers asked you to share some of them with us via voicemail.
I am a veteran and a woman of color, and I found herpetology and wildlife biology on my quest to become a veterinarian. And on that quest, I have met and had some very interesting things said to me from people feeling like, you know, they had to say something like, you know, what's up, my sister, instead of just saying hello, or, you know, I have to dab it instead of just shaking hands. And I had one lady one time, we were on a prescribed burn, and she asked me, aren't you afraid all that hair is going to get caught on fire? She said it right in front of the union rep. No one said anything. So about a year ago, my supervisor found out that I was using my platform as a way to outreach to minority children about wildlife biology and public lands and land management or whatever it was, I could get out there. He was so, you know, hateful or, you know, discouraging with his no. It's made staying in wildlife biology very hard to deal with. It has made being a birder difficult, being a herpetologist difficult. I just took all that in over the last year or so, and I didn't post anything. I stopped. I was discouraged, and I allowed myself to get discouraged and oppressed. And then one of the girls I follow on Instagram, who is also a herpetologist, started sharing about this hashtag in this page. And I said, let me see what this is about. With all the things that are going on, like, I could see some people who look like me. I could use some people who, you know, talk like me and have the same interests as me. And after more than a year of not posting, I decided that the best way to fight back with all that hate was love. Love for what I do, love for sharing it on social media, love for sharing it with my family and friends. This page and this week and these posts have showed me, like, we're out here. I've never been so proud and so inspired and so motivated. I am so happy.
This is Day Scott recording from Lander, Wyoming. The last week has been one of the most difficult weeks in my life.
I am recovering from a traumatic brain injury. So anything in addition to that, that happens just puts me in a very challenging place emotionally.
At a point last week, I didn't even know how to move forward in life. Like, I was in this moment and I did not know what was gonna happen the second moment. It's already hard enough for me right now. I was just thinking, like, well, what next? How much more can I take? I didn't really hear from anybody in my community. And then I got on social media and so many people were just condemning looters and using all sorts of unkind language. It was just very unpleasant to read what they thought was most important. I kept wondering if they even thought about me when they looked at these incidents and murders that were just happening over the last few weeks. This is the same community that came together when I had a brain injury or when I had my car accident. And they came together and took care of me. For me not to see them speak up or even check on me to say, oh, how are you doing? Text me, call me. Like, we live so close together. It was really an eye-opener. As a Black person in Wyoming, I don't walk around at night. I don't know. It just does not feel comfortable for me to do that. When I'm out birding, I always make sure that my equipment can be seen. Along with my, right now, wearing a Cotopaxi backpack. It's really bright and colorful. I want people to see me. I want people to know that, oh, that's just Day. We know her. Because I don't want any incidents. I am here by myself as a Black woman in a small town in Wyoming. When I heard about Black Birders Week, I was able to channel some of the fear, anger, and sadness into hope, awareness, and comfort. I found my voice. I found a lane that I could be in, as I cannot really attend any events with crowds due to my brain injury. Black Birders Week simply made me feel like I belong. Though it was through a virtual community, it created a voice that had been silenced due to fear. It opened the joy of sharing my gift and allowing others to experience nature through my eyes.
Those stories came to us from contributors to Black Birders Week. Thanks to everyone who sent us a story, but for whom we didn't have time. You can still send us your stories by recording one on your smartphone and sending it to outsidein@nhpr.org. Coming up, the story of another space where Black Americans have historically been denied access, the water. This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. There's something familiar about the idea of wilderness as a place that is, quote, unquote, colorblind, a great equalizer, a false trope that's also been applied recently to COVID-19, this idea that the virus or jungle or desert doesn't care about your family background or your income level or the color of your skin. It's true that disease and geography may not care about those things, but to believe that inequality does not impact disease or our access to and relationship with the outdoors is deeply naive and privileged. Before the break, we talked about birdwatching while Black. And in this next segment, produced as part of a longer episode about our relationship with water, producers Daniela Ali and Justine Paradise explore the history and stereotypes associated with swimming and race.
For me, water is magical. I'm definitely in love with the ocean.
This is Ebony Rosemond.
My husband and I have a ritual where it's something that I witnessed for the first time when I was living in Brazil. At the stroke of midnight, everyone rushes into the water and there's all these fireworks, and then everybody just starts partying in the water. So at midnight on New Year's, we always run into the water. And it's always a natural body of water.
So Ebony loves the water, and her daughter actually started swimming when she was just 3 years old. She joined the swim team, and now her daughter's a strong competitive swimmer.
They live in Prince George's County, Maryland, which is a historically Black county.
It's the wealthiest African-American county in the country. So for us, on a local level, we see lots of Black swimmers here in Prince George's County. And my daughter's team, the Teresa Banks Swim Club, which is historically an African-American swim club, was the champion of the league for like 8 years in a row.
So as Ebony's daughter got better and better, when she was 11, she was the fastest 11-year-old in the country in the 50 free. They started going to competitions further afield.
And we're just, you know, proud swim parents. We didn't really know that much about the sport. We honestly didn't really understand how good she was. But we started to notice that we were the only African-American family at the meets she was going to. Like, where are all of the other little Black swimmers? Where are the Black parents? So on the way home from a meet, my daughter Googled on my phone, Black kids swim. And Google returned nothing but negative results.
It's a crazy statistic. African American children are 5 times more likely to drown than other children. I'm Olympic medalist.
We found the USA Swimming statistic that said at that time that 70% of African Americans lacked basic swim skills. The horrific story where I think 5 or 6 kids in Louisiana drowned because they were swimming in open water and they were trying to save one another, and one after another, they just drowned.
These stories and statistics are real, but they also reinforce a stereotype that Black kids don't know how to swim. And then there was the case of the 2016 Red Cross poster illustrating pool safety. The poster depicts behavior that is cool and not cool. Here's Larry Wilmore talking about it on his late night show.
Okay, let's see what we've got here. Okay, cool, all right, white dad playing with this baby in the water. Not cool, Black girl shoving a white girl into the pool. Hey, Quanice from the projects, you leave sweet little Madison alone, please. Okay, what else? Cool white girl standing at the diving board. Not cool. Black boy diving off the diving board? You know they put diving boards at pools for diving, right? What is he diving to, Blackly? Good Lord.
There are positive examples of elite Black swimmers, like Olympians Maritza McClendon, Leah Neal, and Simone Manuel, who was the first Black individual gold medalist in 2016.
Trying to pass Kate Campbell for Olympic gold, and Manuel is going to do it.
But even at the Olympics, you can catch a glimpse of a murky history. For instance, 3-time Olympic medalist Colin Jones almost drowned when he was 5 years old, and his mother couldn't help because she didn't know how to swim either. So, what's going on?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of these myths and stereotypes that have developed Like one of them was that the slave trade was so horrendous that it created this psychological scar on African Americans that was passed down through generations that discouraged them from swimming.
This is Kevin Dawson. He is a surfer, sailor, freediver, and a swimmer.
Kevin's also a historian.
I am a historian of the African diaspora and Atlantic history at the University of California, Merced.
As he started studying history, Kevin found firsthand accounts that the stereotype that Black people can't swim is a recent invention. Not all that long ago, at least relative to the grand sweep of history, in some parts of the world, the reverse was true. Kevin studied observations of coastal peoples in sub-Saharan Africa, from Senegal to Angola, and communities in the interior as Europeans traveled up rivers into what's now Mali and the Congo River Basin.
These were mostly first-hand European accounts from ship logs and diaries starting in the 15th century.
The accounts of Africans diving into rivers and into the ocean to fight crocodiles and sharks with knives, or to fight hippopotamuses with spears.
He also found descriptions of African peoples free diving
to great depths, to 60, 80, 100 feet deep, which Europeans were not able to do at that time.
Meanwhile, the colonizers, the Europeans, largely did not share these fundamental swim skills. They were basically still doing the doggy paddle. Kevin points to a few reasons for this: a belief that swimming can spread disease, and some Catholic officials wrote that because people swam nude, swimming was immoral.
So they go to Africa and they see Africans doing versions of the crawl or the freestyle, and they're really surprised because they instantly recognize that it was a much faster, much stronger stroke that allowed the Africans to swim longer and faster than they ever could. And that's really, to kind of wrap their sense around Africans' ability to swim and their own inabilities to swim, they would say, well, you know, swimming is animalistic, and this is proof that Africans are animalistic or bestial.
But of course, while these skills might have been seen as animalistic, they were still valuable.
The Spanish used slaves for pearl diving. And later in the Caribbean, slaves were used for salvaging gold off shipwrecks, sometimes worth billions of dollars in today's economy.
But there's an idea that plantation owners in the American South stopped enslaved people from swimming. And Kevin's research suggests that wasn't actually too common.
Enslavers saw swimming as a way of preserving their property, right? By preventing slaves from drowning.
What really stopped African Americans from swimming was what happened after slavery.
You basically have two things going on. First, you have the rise of white supremacist groups like the Ku Klux Klan. And so as Black people began to demand political rights during Reconstruction and then after Reconstruction, you had this rise of lynchings, which is kind of spectacle murder of Black people. And lynched bodies were oftentimes discarded in waterways. And they were discarded in waterways where African Americans were using in the rivers and lakes that Black people were swimming in.
Perhaps the most well-known example was Emmett Till, who was 14 years old when he was brutally murdered after he'd been accused of flirting with a white woman. His body was dumped in the Tallahatchie River and pulled out 3 days later.
Oftentimes, throughout the South, Black people were congregating along and under the railroad trestles that spanned rivers. And so these railroad trestles became, if you will, in kind of contested spaces. And so Black people had been jumping off of them, diving off of them. And so as white Southerners were forcing Black people off of these beaches, they began to hang Black people from these bridges. And these bridges then became known as lynching bridges.
There's a legacy of exclusion and fear surrounding the swimming pool in America.
This is Ebony Rosemond again.
During segregation and into integration, we were refused entrance into safe places to swim. whether that was a pool funded by their own tax money or a beachfront.
And as beaches started to become segregated by race,
what white Americans did not want to do was to have white women, semi-nude white women, to be in the same space as semi-nude black men. The incident that sparked the 1919 race riot of Chicago was a black teenager on an inner tube inadvertently floated from a black beach onto a white beach, and a white mob then pelted him with bricks and stones, and he ended up drowning. And that kicked off that 1919 race riot.
Out of a desire to protect their children, older African Americans prevented their children from going to these dangerous places. But of course, everyone loves the water. Everyone wants to swim, especially when it's hot. So children would find other places to swim, drainage ditches, unmonitored open water. So then you have a growing drowning rate in the African American community, which increased the fear. So whether it's out of fear of drowning, out of fear of your child drowning, or out of fear of being harassed, black people have, in some populations, more than others, have avoided the water.
Ebony wanted to do something to change that. So she started an organization rooted from the phrase her daughter had Googled after a swim meet, Black Kids Swim. It's a nonprofit with the mission of getting more kids involved in competitive swimming. They connect kids with summer swim teams, facilitate scholarships, and even design their own hair care products specifically designed for tight curl patterns seen in a lot of black hair.
But to achieve their goal of getting more kids involved in competitive swimming, Ebony and Black Kids Swim could not ignore history.
They also want to know, why am I afraid of swimming? Why did my parents keep me out of the pool? Why aren't there more swimmers?
You have to talk about history to reroute it. So Black Kids Swim started including listening sessions and workshops in their programming with the parents and community in Prince George's County and Washington, D.C.
The idea was to bring into the open this historical trauma or collective memory, which sometimes is actually not just a memory.
Actually, here in Prince George's County, there was an incident with and it's not unique, but a neighborhood pool, a community association that was denying membership to African-American families. And of course, the kids wanted to go anyway. So they said, you know, with the typical courage of a child, well, I'm going anyway. And their father said, fool, don't you go to that pool, they'll drown you. And that was simply a father trying to protect his child from a dangerous, or at the very least, embarrassing situation.
Yeah. And I think both of us are really sort of struck by this, that you've built kind of into your programming, like even though it's about competitive swimming and that's your mission, that like you're creating these spaces for people to share stories in a public but safe forum. Like, is it cathartic for people? Like, what do you observe like in terms of like the emotion of the room?
Yes, it's cathartic. You just see the body language change, and the emotions in the room sway. From shock over the statistics and the lack of participation, and then to very somber when people start to share specific stories with names and dates and specific locations. We did a workshop like this in Washington, D.C. a few months ago, and a woman shared how she watched her husband drown on a family vacation. And after that, of course, she learned how to swim. She made sure her children learned how to swim. But it's very cathartic. It's very healing for a person to be able to share that story, to receive love from the community, and receive encouragement. And I'm sure that after she shared her story, and more importantly, shared how she decided to grow from that horrific incident, it strengthened other people in the audience to do the same. I don't know, now they have a shared experience. And then towards the end of the presentation, when we begin to highlight see successful elite black swimmers in the sport, whether they're American, African, or Caribbean.
It's a dead heat!
Dead heat! Oh, I can't begin to tell you what this means for the sport of swimming in the United States.
Then the pride begins to come out, and we encourage them that, of course, they can do this too, and the kids begin to get excited.
There are also national efforts from groups like the YMCA, the CDC, and the Red Cross to raise pool safety awareness and improve access to swim lessons in areas where drowning rates are above average. But that's different from what Black Kids Swim is doing, giving new swimmers a reason to be proud and building a community. This spring, Black Kids Swim is running their first ever skills camp. And this year was the 17th annual National Black Heritage Championship Swim Meet in Cary, North Carolina, which Ebony calls the family reunion of the Black swim community.
And Kevin Dawson, the historian and freediver, he's also involved in getting Black kids comfortable in the water. He talks to kids and parents to dispel these historical myths. And last year, he actually helped 100 kids learn to surf in California.
So we're happy to say that just 3 years after the founding of Black Kids Swim, if you Google Black Kids Swim now, you'll see only positive stories, or definitely in the majority positive stories. Interviews, highlights of young Black swimmers who are doing awesome things in and out of the pool. So we're just proud that in our own little way, we have been able to make a real difference in what people think when they hear the words or enter the words into a search engine, Black Kids Swim.
That story was produced by Daniela Ali and Justine Paradise. Coming up, the urban heat island effect meets our American history of redlining. Stick around. This is Outside In. I'm Sam Evans Brown. As protests against police violence have swelled to huge numbers this week, so too have temperatures been climbing into one of the first serious heat spells of the year. Here's a clip from Tucson, Arizona's local news affiliate, KUGN9, where temperatures hit triple digits there on Wednesday.
It was over 100 degrees out, but people didn't seem to let that bother them. Among the protesters was Zach Bukarski, a recent University of Arizona grad from Chicago.
Heat is not a factor. This is about more than just uncomfortable, because the people who are getting oppressed by the...
To some, the temperatures may seem divorced from the issues being protested, but a lot of connections can be made between high temperatures and demands for racial justice by Black Americans. Severe heat is the deadliest form of extreme weather in the United States, and because of the design of urban spaces and the country's history of discriminatory housing policies, Black Americans and other marginalized communities are affected in disproportionate numbers. To learn more, producer Taylor Quimby spoke with Rachel Ramirez, an environmental justice reporter at Grist, where you'll find her article, Another Legacy of Redlining: Unequal Exposure to Heat Waves.
Rachel, can you just start with just an overview of what is the urban heat island effect?
Right. So like climate change, the urban heat island effect is made by humans. So several researchers and even the Environmental Protection Agency have said that extreme heat kills more Americans each year than any other hazardous climate-related event. So the urban heat island effect, which makes extreme heat in cities even worse than it already is, happens because of traditional urban design choices. So tall buildings, dark roofs, black pavement cause the air to stagnate, and they all attract and absorb sun rays. So that cities like New York, Chicago, or Los Angeles are way hotter than, say, a suburb that's just a few miles away from that city. And people of color are more likely to live in urban heat islands than white people. As a result, they face more health risks during a heat wave.
I mean, is it measurably stronger or weaker, even within a large city? You know, parts of the city are, on average, have higher temps?
The answer is yes. New York City, for example, is a heat island. But even heat islands can have hot spots. So neighborhoods like Hunts Point in the South Bronx or Sunset Park in Brooklyn, they heat up even more than the overall city. So the neighborhoods we call fence line communities, so quote unquote fence line communities, where residents live alongside industrial facilities like peaker plants or power plants. They tend to have fewer trees or green spaces that help cool an area down. These things like exacerbate the already hot heat conditions that typically low-income communities of color already face. And the South Bronx, especially, is called Asthma Alley. That area has the city's highest rate of emergency care visits for asthma, as well as respiratory hospitalizations. It also has among the neighborhoods hardest hit by COVID-19. And, you know, there's a Harvard study that already links air pollution to higher COVID-19 outcomes.
Right. And you know, what we've been hearing is a really staggering degree to which COVID-19 is affecting people of color disproportionately as well.
Right. Yeah. Right.
When you're thinking about, you mentioned green spaces, you know, urban design in those places. I mean, we know how connected those are to wealth, to race. Can you talk a little bit about the connection between urban design and urban planning and the history of housing developments and some of the other ways that people have been placed really in some of these neighborhoods that are most at risk?
Mm-hmm. Early this year, I wrote a story on how some of the legacies of redlining, which, as most of us know, is the government-sanctioned denial of home loans and insurance to communities of color, particularly Black households, is a strong predictor of which neighborhoods are essentially disproportionately exposed to extreme heat. In other cases, although redlining was banned in the late 1960s, we still see some of its legacies. So predominantly Black neighborhoods are pushed out near a fossil fuel industry or below sea level neighborhoods in Louisiana. So it's not just heat. And one of the things the researchers have told me is that our zip codes are a strong predictor of our health because it shows what we're exposed to. And as I've written before, like so many aspects of the climate crisis, heat doesn't affect all people equally. Marginalized low-income communities of color, they bear the brunt of these extreme weather events. And in some cases, these are neighborhoods with barely any green space to cool the residents down as a result of redlining. These places are drastically hotter than their surrounding suburbs and rural areas. And I'm actually working on a story right now on urban green spaces and kind of asking the question on who has access to those spaces and kind of exploring this idea of urban green displacement or urban green gentrification.
You mean like where parks get located and who, you know, who's actually
right.
able to like get to them either by foot or by transport?
Right. Like it's kind of a case study of New York City's High Line, right? So Chelsea neighborhood used to be a predominantly Black neighborhood or Hispanic neighborhood. And when the High Line came up, it kind of displaced a lot of the communities of color there. They were kind of priced out of that neighborhood. And so kind of exploring the historical aspects of that.
I mean, does it strike you that so many of these protests over George Floyd and over, you know, racial injustice are happening in these streets that are designed in this way?
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things that we've been kind of reporting at GRIS is that environmental injustice is racial injustice. And one of my colleagues, Navina, actually wrote about how some of the state lawmakers have introduced bills that either made, you know, obstructing traffic on highways a crime or, you know, has increased penalties for protesting near an oil and gas facility. And some of these proposals were introduced in response to ongoing protests against controversial oil pipelines. And that's also including or following, you know, the police killing of Philando Castile. I also wrote about St. James Parish in Louisiana, mm-hmm. which is a really good case. In the middle of the pandemic, the LDEQ, the Louisiana Department of Environmental Quality, approved permits for this gigantic petrochemical facility to set up shop in St. James in the middle of the pandemic when the Harvard study came out of connecting air pollution and severe COVID-19 outcomes. And I don't know if you saw news, but that petrochemical facility would set up shop on top of two former sugarcane plantation sites and also part of a slave burial ground. So it's kind of like this threat multiplier for African Americans, and these companies are setting up shop in these communities because they think that they wouldn't fight back or they don't have the capacity to know what's going on.
Would you, studying and reporting on these issues, I mean, do you see divisions among climate activists about how much emphasis to put on environmental justice when it comes to, you know, the strategy of climate change? I know I've seen in some recent months at least a couple of high-profile writers who are basically getting trolled by followers who want the issues to be separate and dislike when environmental justice is at the fore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. First of all, I think a lot of times people don't really understand that the environmental justice beat. For instance, last week, you know, in the midst of all the protests, one journalist asked something along the lines of on Twitter, does the media industry need more journalists whose beats focus on criminal justice? And like, if not, which beats do you wish existed in newsrooms? And, you know, I live on Twitter, so I replied, environmental justice. And the response was something like, that's right, we can't report if we end up killing the planet or something like that, which is true, but not entirely the point that I was trying to make, because environmental justice disproportionately kills Black people because, you know, of the air they breathe from nearby fossil fuel facilities. And from my reporting, oil and gas companies choose to set up shop in neighborhoods of color, as I mentioned, because they have this notion that, you know, they could get away with air permit violations because they think the residents don't know anything. Well, the reality is they do, because these communities are noticing a trend and many of them are fighting back. And yes, I do think there's a divide among climate activists, because it's environmental justice is one of those things that's so complex where people think climate change is just about saving the planet or more extreme weather events. But when it comes to communities, we have to look deeper into, you know, the corporations in power or government officials working to regulate these violations and that are affecting the climate and also the health of communities of color.
Hmm. Do you see, I mean, you mentioned, you know, this Twitter post that's happening right now. Do you think that the protests that are taking place in this moment are changing the narrative in terms of climate activism and environmental justice?
Yeah, I think it's also hard to say, but there is a narrative change right now. In part, I'm thinking thanks to all the young people. Last year, 2019, was sort of a momentous year for the climate movement, especially led by the youth. I was at the UN General Assembly last September and met many of the youth activists from around the world. And I think it's incredible that, you know, they see more deeply into these situations more clearly than the older generation. You know, they're worried about their future, and rightfully so. And it's brave of them to take on corporations like Exxon, BP, Chevron, and whatnot. You know, I think they have changed the narrative and they've pushed the needle and moved forward the climate conversation.
Any recommended reading before I let you go for listeners who just want to know more about the connections between race, housing, climate, all the stuff that we've been talking about?
Right. You know, there's a ton of books and resources out there in which, you know, you could sort of get a sense of the intersection between environmental justice and housing segregation and race. And one of my favorite actually is The 1619 Project by Nicole Hannah-Jones, mm-hmm. whose work, you know, I love so much. Highlights a few of those intersections, starting from the plantation farms. There's also this book that my colleague Yvette Cabrera recommended to me called Moving Toward Integration, the Past and Future of Fair Housing, which discusses migration from rural to urban areas in the South, including the Great Migration to cities like Detroit and Chicago. And I think lastly, I highly encourage reading the work that we do at GRIS, since we do work really hard to write about the intersection of race and climate justice.
Well, Rachel, thank you so much for the recommendations, and thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much, Taylor.
That was Rachel Ramirez, an environmental justice fellow at GRIST, speaking with producer Taylor Quimby. This episode was produced by Justine Paradise, Daniela Ali, Taylor Quimby, and me, Sam Evans-Brown. Erica Janik is our executive producer. Maureen McMurray is the director of content. That is her actual job title, by the way. Special thanks to Dr. Angela Beale from the Red Cross and to the organizers and participants from Black Birders Week for sharing their stories. Music in this episode from Jazzar, Blue Dot Sessions, Ash Turner, Broke for Free, and Ikimashu Aoi. Our theme music is by Breakmaster Cylinder. Join us on our newsletter. We are sharing interesting links, good reading, and occasionally pictures of us goofing off behind the scenes. You can sign up at outsideinradio.org. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.